the voyage, when the sky around the ship hadn't seemed so terribly different to that witnessed at night from Earth. Scattered stars, many sun-like. Slowly, they had learned to read the meaning of that shifting assemblage. The local stars were a mixture of ages and types, and all were in motion. Only the very youngest had been born in the vicinity of Sol. The rest had been visitors. Sol itself had been born with other long-scattered siblings in a distant nursery cloud. Seen on a long enough timescale, such a sky was a transitory assemblage, Jophiel thought, like passengers in an elevator car, a disparate group never to be gathered again. But as they had pushed towards the galaxy centre, the quality of the view had changed. As seen from Earth, much of the splendour of the galaxy had been hidden by clouds of dust, grit and ice expelled from old dying stars and lingering in the plane of the galaxy. Now those dust clouds were behind them, and the sky had become much more complex, with crowds of stars and less familiar features, bubbles and filaments of gas, coherent structures light-years across, evidence of the birth and death of stars visible to the naked eye. Jophiel glanced around at the crew. The meetings generally got a lot livelier later, when internal matters were discussed, crew rotas, even disciplinary issues. But Goober's glorious dioramas only drove home how very far from Earth they were. Even the sky was utterly alien, and people were subdued. The unfolding of deep time was staggering, too. 6,000 light-years of travel translated roughly to 6,000 years in elapsed time outside. 6,000 years since the Chile attack, since the displacement, the creation of cold Earth, since the scattering of mankind in thousands of fragile starships. The gulf of time that now separated Jophiel from those events, which he himself remembered vividly, was the same as the interval that had separated his own age of interplanetary industry from the Bronze Age. And it was a terrifying thought that this fragile life dome was the only known shelter for human life within 6,000 light-years. No wonder the crew, whenever they could, turned inward from the bleak wastes of space and time that surrounded them. Turned inward and concentrated on chores and rotas and lovemaking and babies, even on Max Ward's obsessive military drilling, the subject of much mockery by Nicola.
"So," Goober said, "you understand where we are. We've travelled about a quarter of the way to the galaxy centre, although, because of the oddities of time dilation, we've already lived through about half the journey time, 10 more years to go. We're still a long way from the core, still out here in the spiral arms. But we've already travelled out of the Orion arm, the sun's local arm, and we're passing into Sagittarius, the next arm in, and one of the galaxy's great star-making regions."
Susan Chen said, "And in Sagittarius, somewhere, lies the homeworld of the ghosts. I spent 1,000 years with the ghosts, most of it listening. You pick up a lot of clues, even around creatures so smart. I believe that what we encountered at Goober's Star was the result of ghost expeditions out towards the edge of the galaxy. From their point of view, expeditions out into the wilderness. Of course, they were drawn towards us by the Chile presence in our solar system."
"Good point," Max Ward said heavily. "Maybe our resident ghost could confirm it."
He meant Nicola, of course. The crew, expecting fireworks, looked more alert. And glancing around, Jophiel realized he couldn't see Nicola. Her silver statue persona wasn't exactly hard to spot.
"Where is she?" Max snapped now, as if reading Jophiel's thoughts. "Not exactly easy for her to get lost, is it? So where's she hiding? What's she doing right now? Who's with her? Who's supervising her?"
He jabbed a finger at random.
"Do you know? Do you? Whose orders is she following? Michael Poole's or the ghosts who made her?"
Ben Goober stood again.
Come on, Max. We all flew out of cold earth with Nicola. We've all known her for 9 years, many of us for longer than that. She's not...
What? What is she? What is she not?
She was in the hands of the ghosts, remember?
A prisoner? As I was.
Susan Chen pointed out mildly. But you weren't rebuilt by those meatballs, were you? Why did they do it? To what end?
Well, how would I know?
Nicola's voice ringing like a bell in the clean air. People looked up, grinned. There was even a smatter of applause. Jophiel never forgot that Nicola was popular on this tub. Indeed, some of her monopole bandits from the War for Earth had followed her on this long journey.
I'm listening. In fact, I'm watching. I'm down in the engine pod, locked into a maintenance bay, if you want to know, here to do my duty, to do some work, and to stay one step ahead of you, Max.
That won't save you, Ward said calmly.
Jophiel felt faintly perturbed at all this. It was Max's job to identify threats, but there hadn't been a shred of evidence that Jophiel could see that Nicola was any kind of threat, as opposed to a victim of the ghosts. And Max's destructive obsession with her seemed to Jophiel a hint of that lack of judgment, that instability he had suspected in Max before. As if the man was filling the vacuum of the voyage by picking a pointless fight. Now Poole, who Jophiel suspected shared his own reservations, stood over Ward.
Enough with the intimidation, Max. If you've got some kind of case to make against Nicola, let's hear it.
Fair enough.
Ward stood, with a few gestures waved away Goober's astrophysical displays, and brought up another map of the local galaxy, an idealized sketch of the rim of the Sagittarius arm. The position of the couchy was a bright blue dot, and a few shards of red pulsed here and there all around the chip.
You can see this, can you, Emery?
Get on with it. He glared around at the crew.
Ben Goober told you where we are. Well, here's another map. Here we are, this blue speck, all alone in a dark and dangerous night. As Chen said, the ghost homeworld is somewhere in this spiral arm. And these red pulses. Anybody care to guess? Battlegrounds. This is a map of a war. We've seen the flaring of weaponized energy. We even recognized planet buster beams. But we don't think we're looking at the Chile here.
The ghosts, Jophiel guessed.
Or the Chaks.
We saw at Goober's star that they both had planet busters, Chile technology.
Right. And as you might also have noticed, they started fighting there, back at Goober's star, while we ran for our lives. The Chaks and the ghosts. That was nearly 5,000 years ago, remember? By external time, the universe's clock. Since then, it seems the war has gone on. 5,000 years. And it has spread, as you can see, deep into the Sagittarius arm.
Ben Goober stood again.
I don't get it. We've been travelling close to light speed all this time. Some of those conflicts are happening ahead of us, deeper into the arm, towards the galaxy's centre.
Oh. Ward grinned.
Oh, you got it, Ben. Both the Chaks and the ghosts have something we don't. A hyperdrive, faster than light travel. And so they've been pushing ahead of us, all around us. They seem to be fighting all across this galactic sector. And what we're seeing, in signals brought on tardy light waves, is evidence of the war. A war through which we're tiptoeing. He glared around. Like one of your precious children wandering around in a minefield.
Jophiel was dismayed by the extent of this ghost-Chaks war, and puzzled.
On Earth, the number of the year was AD 10,000, more or less, and Jophiel knew that by now, According to the fragmentary information about the future held in the family archives, humanity should already have won a successful war against the ghosts. Indeed, a genocidal war. Well, that hadn't happened, had it? Instead, he found himself here, fleeing through a war between Chax and Ghost, itself millennia old, that, maybe, should never have come to pass. He caught his template's eye. Poole was frowning, maybe thinking the same thoughts. Poole shrugged. Jophiel tried to focus. Max was still speaking, and not about existential shifts in reality, but proximate dangers to the mission. We are in a situation of extreme peril. Even if it doesn't feel like it in this bubble, and even aboard this ship, right on the inside with us, now we have the ghost thing that calls itself Nicola Emery, which won't even show itself today. We know it has been re-engineered by the ghosts and therefore must have ghost technology embedded. He looked up at the empty air. Here's a reference for you, Emery. You always liked mythology and such, didn't you? Maybe you should be stopped while we've got the chance, because maybe you're a Trojan horse. There was a shocked silence, and Susan Chen stood. She always looked so frail, Jophiel thought with a pang of conscience, as if she might collapse at any moment. Yet she stood there, silent, waiting until Poole nodded to her. You will not harm Nicola Emery, she said slowly, or the being she has become. For you are right, Maxwell Ward, that she is not as she was. She is enhanced, a new being of an order that did not exist in the universe before Guba's star. Oh, maybe there was an element of punishment or even containment in what the ghosts did to her. She had defied them, remember. But she was not created for reasons of intended harm. Max said coldly, Then why? Just to see how humans work? Not that. She glanced uncertainly at Poole. I know you have no secrets before your crew, Michael. And I know, because Nicola told me, that your family holds or held information about the future, as it should have worked out. She looked around at the crew, at the parents with their infants. But the ghosts, too, have their own sources of information about the future. So I learned, in a millennium of listening, they have a technology they call the Seers. I believe some kind of advanced quantum computing devices that enabled glimpses of the far future, or at least of possible futures. The ghosts believed, you see, Michael, that the amulet you were given by your wormhole ghost was itself a seer, but of an unfamiliar design. Well, it came from a different timeline. And I learned something of their dreams of the future, more secrets in hints and scraps. She spoke so softly that she could barely be heard, yet she held the whole crew in the palm of her hand. The ghosts believe that in the very far future there will be an ending. Universal. No, not that. A transition between one cosmic state and another, just as there have been many such transitions in the past, from uniformity to complexity, from dark to light. And Jophiel remembered similar dark hints contained in the pool's own archive of arcana. His mother's voice reciting a strange prophecy. Time unravelled, dying galaxies collided like clapping hands, But even now the story was not yet done. The universe itself prepared for another convulsion, greater than any it had suffered before. And then... He caught Michael Poole's eye. Michael nodded curtly, so his template was remembering too. Susan went on, "And the ghosts, you see, believed that life and mind could survive this great convulsion of the future only if there was cooperation. Between ghosts and humans and others, perhaps, life forms from extreme ages, the deep past, the far future. And so when a handful of humans fell into their hands, maybe they recognized us from their own prophecies. They remade Nicola, Jophiel said, as an experiment, a kind of hybrid.
Not quite that, Nicola said now. More a symbiosis, one life form working with another to make something greater. Just as the ghosts themselves are already symbiotic organisms, multiple creatures locked inside those shiny shells, helping each other stay alive in a hostile universe.
Yes, Jophiel thought. A further extension of the ghosts' expansion of the self, now including even humans. Nicola sounded proud, yet bitter, defiant. She laughed.
I am the face of the future. Who'd have thought it?
And so, Max Ward said heavily, what? There seemed nothing more to say. For now, Poole broke up the meeting. The crew started to disperse. Max glared at Poole and stalked away. When they were alone, Nicola called Michael and Jophiel together, whispering in their ears.
A few points, Nicola said. I think I may stay down here in the gut drive pod for the time being.
Michael Poole seemed conflicted. Look, I'll protect you from Max. I'm sorry I can't fix you.
Nicola shrugged. I'm not asking you to.
Poole said with a flare of anger, You didn't follow me, though. When the island split off, if you had, maybe this wouldn't have come about. You followed him, Jophiel. So I brought it on myself.
Enough, Jophiel said. Nicola, come back to the Life Dome. To Leith with Max.
She shook her head.
I can't. And you know why, I think. Because he might just be right. Because I might be a Trojan horse after all. I mean, I wouldn't know it, would I? Max is an idiot, but if there's even a 1% chance that he's right... To be honest, logically, you should kill me yourselves. Whichever of you is stronger.
Chapter 30 Ship elapsed time since launch. 9 years, 307 days. Earth date, circa 16,200 AD. 9 months later came the turnaround. The Cauchy's mission plan was simple, in essence. Blast at a steady one Earth gravity thrust, as experienced within the craft, for half the distance to the galaxy core, then shut down briefly, turn around, literally, and start firing the gut engine the other way, again with a one gravity thrust. The deceleration would bring the craft neatly to a halt at the heart of the galaxy, though, to put it mildly, Jophiel knew the details of the closing stages had yet to be worked out. So now, alone, somewhere in the galaxy's giant Norma arm, the human starship Cauchy shut down its primary engine, its gut drive. Everybody aboard the ship, from the youngest baby to the unreal Jophiel, felt that strange dropping elevator release in the gut as the acceleration died. There followed an odd sense of stillness, Jophiel thought, and of remoteness suddenly crowding in. Since Max Ward's challenging of Nicola, the craft had travelled another 6,500 light-years further towards the centre. As measured at the sun, it was now more than 12,000 years since their departure. Such numbers made no sense in human terms, so it was best not to think about it and to get on with the work. And there was plenty of that. The planning of the turnaround, a key milestone in the voyage, had been the subject of much debate. It had been hard even to decide how long it should take. After nearly 10 years of continuous flight, the engineers, including Jophiel himself, wanted plenty of time to run routine maintenance. On the other hand, the medics, led by Harris Kemp, worried about the effect of extended periods of weightlessness on the crew, especially the latest cadre of infants born within the last couple of years or so. In the end, they had settled upon 10 days of zero-thrust turnaround, and as soon as the shutdown came, the crew got to work. Jophiel helped Poole with much of the coordination. Crews of humans and bots crawled over the inert gut-drive pod, worked the length of the ship's spine seeking cumulative stress problems, and picked their way over the life dome's outer surface, patching flaws where, despite the shielding provided by the wormhole interface, the near-light-speed sleet of the sparse interstellar material had managed to get through. From now on, of course, the burning engine pod would lead the way, thrusting against the direction of travel, and tweaks of the exhaust plumes would blast a tunnel through the ice, gas, and dust that littered interstellar space. There was some debate about ditching the wormhole interface altogether, now that even its secondary purpose of shielding the ship was gone. But Poole and Jophiel vetoed that. The exotic matter frame itself represented a store of energy, and besides, though Ireland was lost for good, Gia, the flotilla's third vessel, was still out there somewhere, and the Poole still had a notion or a dream of reconnecting with that lost crew some day. Inside the life dome, too, there was work to do. Floor plates were taken up to expose a huge infrastructure of waste processors and food printers and pumps and vents and dehumidifiers and heaters through which engineers worked their way. The children found this hugely exciting and had to be kept from exploring the caves of steel revealed beneath their feet. But in this strange interlude, there was also an opportunity for some constructive work. Asher Fennell and her small team ran through a program of specialized observations. The crew of the Cauchy were already far into galactic realms unseen by human eyes before, not even telescopically from Earth, thanks to intervening dust clouds. Beyond the plane of the galaxy, too, there was the dark matter halo and its mysterious structures to explore, and further yet, what Asher Fennell called the crystalline clarity of extragalactic space. Of course, they had carried out such observations in flight, and now such was their velocity even without thrust, the view was still folded up by the aberration of light. But, as Asher tried to explain tactfully, even Poole Industries' finest gut engines did come with the slightest of murmurs, vibrations which could only distract from the immensely delicate observations the astronomers were trying to make. So in this brief interval of stillness, Asher and her team worked feverishly. Meanwhile, Maxwell Ward took the chance to put every crew member he could get his hands on through zero-gravity military drill exercises. Max's training was always popular with the young, Jophiel had observed, if only because it gave them something to do, some structure in their lives. There was time for fun, too. Jophiel was astonished to see infants sent drifting in the air like balloons by their parents. After 5 days, the turnover manoeuvre itself was another challenge for the engineers and crew. The whole ship had to be rotated end over end to get that big gut engine pod pointed in the right direction. The ship's frame was configured for greatest strength in the direction of thrust, with life dome leading an engine pod at the rear. Of course, it was designed to cope with off-axis manoeuvres too. The basic gutship design had been intended primarily for short-haul missions within the solar system, with a requirement for manoeuvring and docking at either end of a journey. But they were 12,000 light-years from home, and with only one ship left. So the engineers took the rotation manoeuvre slowly and carefully. The 3 kilometres long batten that was the ship tipped with painful slowness, a swarm of bots and engineers watching every step. Asha and her astronomy team complained bitterly about the loss of observing time as the ship turned from a stable platform into a pinwheel, but Poole overrode her. Then, Asha called a meeting of the seniors 2 days before the gut drive was scheduled to start up again. Chapter 31. Poole gave over his apex sweet again, and Asha opened the debate with a grand sweep of her arm. A virtual of the galaxy appeared in the air in the middle of the room, a fat, bright bulge of stars at the centre, the great surrounding disk with its spiral arms. The image was so beautiful, its appearance so dramatic, that it evoked gasps from the surrounding watchers, who were hanging in a rough sphere around the display, zero gravity suspended in the air. The complex light cast highlights from Nicola's gleaming silver limbs. Asha Fennell, quiet and studious, was learning showmanship, Jophiel thought wistfully. Maybe it was in the nature of the subject matter. Astrophysics dealt with the grandest objects in the universe. How could you not be spectacular? Asha looked around at them. "Now I've got your attention," she said dryly, "I need to tell you what we've been discovering. It's not just abstract knowledge. I think it changes our deepest understanding of, well, of the nature of the universe, and of the meaning of our own mission." Nicola grinned. "Oh, good. I love it when that happens." Jophiel had to grin back. Physically, Nicola, wary of Max, was still lodged safely in the engine compartment, but she had grown weary of her isolation, and she had started to project virtuals like this one. Despite her self-professed revulsion at throwing off short-lived partials, it was a price she was prepared to pay, for now, to keep out of Max's way while not missing the good stuff like this. "Get on with it," growled Michael Poole. Asha continued doggedly. "What I'll show you is a synthesis of the observations we've been making since launch. Observations of phenomena no human eye or probe ever saw before us. And now backed up with some precision sightings taken during the turnaround." "So," Asha said, gesturing at her image, "what you see is the baryonic matter galaxy, the light matter stuff." A beacon, bright blue, sparked into life in the disk, in a spiral arm halfway between edge and core. "Here we are. And what we've been looking for primarily has been infestations of intelligent life." Nicola laughed. "Infestations. Good word. Infestations like us and the ghosts and the Chaks." "Yes. Start with that. We've got 2 sources of information about intelligence in the spiral arms. The old data from the pool archives and the wormhole ghosts information. Glimpses of a lost future. And our own new observations. So, at Guba's star, leaving aside the Chili and the dark matter creatures for now, we found the 3 species of intelligent technological star-faring species had made it there independently. Species of light matter, that is, As you say, Nicola, us, the ghosts, the checks. If you guess that that's a typical density, that you have three species interacting in a radius of 1,000 light-years... Nicola nodded. I like puzzles. Three in a disk of 1,000 light-years radius, so in a spiral galaxy 100,000 light-years across, you might expect... what, a few thousand civilizations? Asher shrugged. Well, that's a guess, better than nothing. That might not seem so many in a galaxy of hundreds of billions of stars. If you want my guess, life is common, maybe even universal, but technological starfarers are relatively rare. Michael Poole frowned. But you have been looking. And I'm guessing you found some, even so, or you wouldn't be here talking about it, right? Asher nodded. The ghost Chax War is far behind us now, despite the way hyperdrive transports allowed it to spread faster than light. But as we have crossed the galaxy, we have found... traces. Jophiel was fascinated. Traces? Signatures, Asher said gloomily, of civilization, of industry, sparsely scattered, and not many are extensive beyond a star system or two, not the way the Chax ghost war sprawled across thousands of light-years. And a few times we've seen clear evidence of a kind of decadence, even destruction. She began to list classes of evidence of vanished cultures. She reminded them that Goober's star system had shown evidence of being mined out, regularized, perhaps by some culture that had vanished long before ghosts, Chax, Chili, or humans turned up. Even Anthropocene-era Earth could have destroyed itself in a way that would have been visible to cultures on Alpha Centauri or further out, Jophiel learned now. An all-out nuclear war would have produced a flash of gamma rays visible across interstellar distances, but only lasting a few hours, perhaps. Some of the longer-lasting effects, an atmosphere gone opaque through a nuclear winter, the depletion of ozone and other perturbations of the air, would have lingered and would have been detectable from afar. We're probably not recognizing all that we see, Asher said. Maybe some of those who survive war and conquest go on to some advanced plane of existence we know nothing about. What we don't see is any sign of a thriving interstellar empire. No lanes of transport, no huge multi-species space liners crossing the stars. Lots of diversity, though, it sounds like, Nicola said. Yes. Because humans never got here, Jophiel said heavily. In this timeline. Not after the Chile intervention and the scattering. Right, Asher said. By now, there should have been a wave of human expansion out of the solar system and the Orion Arm that was called, in some pool archive accounts, the Assimilation. A huge disruption right across the galactic disk, and an extinction event, if you like, to rival on a galactic scale the Columbian Exchange, when the Europeans of the Discovery Era started to ship slavery, diseases and rats around the planet. Nicola grinned at Poole, not unsympathetically, Jophiel thought. She said, an extinction event, though, which you seem to have, well, inspired in one timeline, Poole, at least one timeline. But then the Chile intervened. Here's something I've heard the crew muttering about, when they've seen some of this data, the younger ones who don't have our cultural baggage, who've grown up as refugees. Look, if the Chile that invaded the solar system averted a galaxy-wide extinction, a bonfire of life and culture, did it do a good thing? By some higher measure of morality, and if so... maybe we're wrong to try to kill it for its troubles. To describe the shocked silence that followed as awkward, Jophiel thought, didn't begin to cut it. What an astounding swivel of perspective.
"We are where we are," Michael Poole said gruffly. "We've made our choices. And we just have to continue, that's all."
"What else would you have me do?"
"What?"
And even Jophiel, looking into his own simulated heart, had no answer. With some relief, Asher said, "Now for the bigger picture." Jophiel stared.
"Bigger than this?"
"Oh, yes. Like I said, at least we had some familiarity with what goes on in the spiral arms. Here's what we didn't understand so well." She waved her hands again. Now the galaxy image tipped up, shrank down to the size of a dinner plate, and a wider shell, transparent with a silvery glimmer, materialized around the galaxy itself, dwarfing it. "Here's my representation of the galaxy's dark matter halo on its grossest of scales. We relied a lot on the data compiled by the Gear in the early days, though we have built on that since. You can see most of the dark matter is out, beyond the visible edge of the galaxy, but not all of it. Look. See that silver plane embedded in the disk? There is actually a significant density of dark matter down there within the visible disk, which is, as I've said, very thin comparatively in itself. How does it get down there? We have records of some very ancient observations of these phenomena, and theories almost as ancient, some of which we can confirm now, we think. You see, we do know some things about dark matter. We know it's made of sparticles, in the jargon, supersymmetric copies of regular baryonic matter particles. And we think now that dark matter has its own set of physical laws, its own forces, like our nuclear electromagnetic gravitational forces. The complication is that the dark matter suite of forces is not the same as ours. We only have one overlap, in fact, gravity. That's the only way dark matter influences our baryonic universe directly, but that is a pretty significant way. The lack of any further overlap makes dark matter hard even to observe, hence dark. But the existence of those other forces implies structure in the dark matter realm. You see, it's just as a baryonic matter star, say, has structure coming from a balance between physical forces, gravity, which tends to compress its bulk, and electromagnetic energy from the core fusion, which tends to blow it apart. Similarly, dark matter structures can form from a balance of relevant forces. In particular, if you have some equivalent of electromagnetism, a way to radiate energy, then you have a way to cool down. And objects that cool down can collapse down into a gravity well. And that, Jophiel realized now, was how come there was that fine dark matter skim within the thin layer of the galactic disk. Dark matter that had cooled, slowed down, got trapped in the gravity well of the galaxy disk. They debated this, questioning and speculating. There was an almost collegiate atmosphere at times like this, Jophiel thought, as if they were a field expedition from some far distant university, whereas Max Ward thought the ship should be more like a warship. Jophiel had always suspected that they weren't going to get anywhere near their objectives without learning, without acquiring a deep understanding of what they were facing in its context. So collegiate made him happy. "But life," Michael Poole broke in. "You keep speaking of structure. Are you talking about life in the dark matter? Those big tendrils Flammarion said she saw reaching down into the galaxy disk. Life, even, mind." Harris Kemp, the nearest to a biology specialist they had on board, rubbed his nose doubtfully.
Well, maybe. That's still a heck of a stretch. But how could such things evolve, or even breed?
And Nicola's silver face was suddenly transformed, the mouth open, the eyes wide. Jophiel, startled, thought he had never seen such an authentic human expression on that reconstructed face of ghost hide. She disappeared. Poole and Jophiel shared a glance. Jophiel said,
"She seems overexcited. Do you think she's okay?"
Michael shrugged. "She's suspicious of her own nature, of herself. She will never be okay again. But she has a good brain, in her way. I think she's come up with something, that's all." And Nicola returned, with a box of construction material, or at least a virtual replica, the big lens that she and Asher had saved from the ghost's station at Goober's Star. Chapter 32. The big lens-shaped box crowded out the suite. Poole snapped, "What on earth are you doing, Nicola?" "Planning to return a child to its mother, I think. That's too anthropomorphic, but that's the basic idea."
Jophiel frowned. "What mother? What child?"
"Oh." And he saw it all at once, just as Nicola must have before him. "The Fotino fish."
"Yes!
Look, Jophiel, Michael, we should have put the pieces together before. You were there with me."
"Where?"
"In the sun, Jophiel, in the sun! Where we discovered the Fotino fish for ourselves. And again, there they were inside Goober's Star, where this specimen was taken from. Probably in every star in the galaxy, for all we know."
"So?"
"So, look at the two places we think we've observed dark matter life. In the halo of the galaxy and in the heart of stars. Huge scale on one hand, tiny cramped confines on the other. Why would dark matter creatures be found there in those contrasting places? Unless..."
Asher nodded, excited herself now. "I think I'm starting to see it. Unless they needed to be there.
That's it.
Here's what I'm thinking now. The dark beasts, the big tentacled monsters out in the halo, represent only part of the life cycle. I'm thinking salmon and oceans and rivers. Jophiel, salmon live in the ocean, but they have to go upriver to breed, right? Same here. Those big dark matter cloud entities live out beyond the galaxy, but they can't breed there. Why? I don't know. Maybe they need density, compression, because of the information that must be exchanged between parent and offspring. Maybe two clouds couldn't mate, they would just intermingle, something like that. But there are places in the universe, little pits of gravity, where they could squeeze down and find the compression they need."
"In the heart of stars," Asher said.
"Right! We know gravity works on dark matter creatures. We know they are immune to heat and radiation. So the galaxy is like a great reef to them, full of these tight little pits, the gravity wells of stars where they can deposit their eggs, which hatch out to become Fotino fish, as we called them, swimming around inside the stars like the sun, like larvae. And when they are mature..."
Jophiel said, "Ah, they hatch out.
As if a star was an egg, they fly back up out of the stars, out of the disk, up into the halo, and open their wings."
Asher laughed. "Just like salmon swimming up rivers. Like turtles coming to the beaches to spawn. I love it, Nicola. It's too beautiful to be wrong."
"So now," Nicola said, "the right thing to do is obvious. We release the lava from that hull plate pod that the ghost trapped it inside.
Jophiel, no.
No, Jophiel snapped out the word. He looked around at surprised frowns. He looked at Michael and got a blank stare back in response. He had surprised himself, but he knew he was right.
No, he said. I'm sorry. We need to hold on to that pod for now. I can't explain. Call it intuition.
Nicola grinned.
Virtuals have intuition, do they?
Jophiel glared at his template.
Michael, you need to trust me. It's important.
And he thought how he wished he felt he could tell Michael of that other pool, the reality leak traveller, who seemed to hover over him like a guilty conscience. Poole stared back at him. He looked oddly lost. Then he nodded curtly. Leave the pod in its store for now, Nicola. After all, we can always release the fish later.
Asher looked baffled, irritated. Well, you did a good deed, Nicola, or tried to.
Yes, don't spread it around.
So you have it, Asher said. Our journey, our ant-like crawl across the galaxy, even the fireworks between the Chaks and the ghosts, all against the context of a galaxy-wide ecology that was so huge in scale we never even noticed it before. Moving on, here's what else we saw.
Jophiel gaped. There's more yet. Further out. Another wave of her hand, and the galaxy, dark matter, shell and all, shrank to the size of a toy, of a human hand, and it was joined in the image by more toys. More galaxies, Jophiel saw one big spiral that looked like it outmassed the Milky Way itself, and a clutter of others, perhaps 2-3 dozen, all of them much smaller than the 2 big dogs of the pack.
So, Asher said, looking beyond our own galaxy, here's what you get. The local group. The big beast is the Andromeda Galaxy, of course. Right now, around 2 million light-years away. That's not much on the scale of these objects, maybe 20 galaxy diameters. And in fact, as you probably know, Andromeda and our galaxy may be heading for a collision, perhaps 3-4 billion years from now. I mention it as something we might have to deal with if Michael keeps us plummeting into the future. Polite laughter. Much later, Jophiel would remember this exchange, Asher's gentle joke, the laughter. And zooming out further, that compact little group shrank down to a detail in a much larger conglomeration of galaxies and galaxy clusters.
The Virgo supercluster, Asher said. 100 million light-years wide, hundreds of galaxies, which come in all sizes and ages, from dwarfs up to monsters, about 100 times our galaxy's mass. Some galaxies are younger than others. Some so old they are nothing but wrecks full of red dwarfs and stellar remnants. As for the scale, I'll expand again and again. A zoom out. More clusters and superclusters, gathering in threads and planes in 3 dimensions. You can see that the Virgo group is itself part of a greater mass, called the Pisces Cetus supercluster, 1 billion light-years across. The threads and sparks of light were assembling into an open structure. Now, to Jophiel, the image didn't look so much like a cosmological picture as something caught under a microscope. The cluster of atoms that made up a base molecule, say, which in turn were threaded on the fragile spiral of a DNA molecule. This is the universe on the largest of scales we can observe, Asher said.
Remarkable, Susan Chen said. The cosmos is so empty.
Nicola shook her head.
It's like a room full of cobwebs.
Well, that's not a bad analogy. Asher pointed out details. Galaxies gather in clusters, which gather into superclusters and features we call walls, these threads and sheets. We think all of this is a product of the way the early universe emerged from the Big Bang, a sea dominated by dark matter, more or less smooth, but with turbulence. And the baryonic matter, the light matter, gathered in the dips and the cracks.
Nicola grinned. A universe like the back of a giant turtle, like in some old myths. And the galaxies are like diamond dust scattered on the turtle's shell, gathering in the folds and pocks.
But it isn't static, Asher said. All the galaxies, all of this structure is in motion.
Another wave of the hand, and the galaxy pinpoints were color-coded in a manner obvious for a spacefarer, red for receding, blue for approaching, like Doppler shift.
Almost all of the picture was colored red, Jophiel saw, startled.
Asher drew the obvious conclusion.
You can see that aside from a little random motion, all the galaxies, including our own, and their clusters are being pulled across space. And this organized flow is on a tremendous scale. All this has been measured before. We are only confirming models themselves thousands of years old.
That, said Susan Chen, is a lot of moths. But what is the flame?
Asher looked at her.
This is what we weren't able to show you before the shutdown.
She clapped her hands and the images disappeared, leaving the room feeling dark and cold and empty, Jophiel thought, though he was as unreal as those images himself. And in the darkness, something appeared. Jophiel squinted to see, small, remote, blurred, surrounded by mist. Perhaps a torus tilted up. A ring.
Jophiel stared and looked across at Michael Poole. They had seen this before, another object enigmatically glimpsed in the amulet of the silver ghost.
The generation who discovered this, I think it was the 21st century or maybe the 20th, called it the Great Attractor, Asher said softly. The great mass that is drawing in all the galaxies across the observable universe. They couldn't see it, but they could infer its existence, its distance and mass, just by looking at your great cloud of moths, Susan. Now we can image it almost. We think this thing is 150 million light-years away. We think it has as much mass as tens of thousands of galaxies, and we think it itself is perhaps 10 million light-years across.
She sketched out the ring shape with her finger. The whole of the Andromeda Milky Way pair would fit inside that structure.
Structure? Michael Poole turned his head sharply. Do you mean an artificial structure, a construct 10 million light-years wide?
He turned to Jophiel. And we thought our wormholes were big engineering.
Jophiel asked, What in Leith is it made of?
Well, we can't know, Asher said a little testily. I've had one suggestion that it could be some variant of cosmic string.
Which, Jophiel knew, was a defect in space-time itself, a remnant of the initial singularity. Atom-thin, a rope-like floor whipping through space at near light-speed, and massive enough to bend space-time around it.
Somebody is using that as a building material.
But what is this for, Asher? We can only guess.
Now Asher, clearly cautious, began to describe measurements made right at the limit of her instrument's capabilities.
For a start, she said, there is some very exotic radiation coming from the ring's central region. We suspect the ring itself isn't just massive, it may be rotating, and is creating a singularity of some kind at the center.
Ripping a hole in space, Nicola murmured.
I admit, I'm impressed.
Also, Asher pushed on doggedly, we are seeing what looks like planet buster beam radiation backwash around the central structure.
Chivi,
Nicola said immediately. Fighting. And further out still, a dense concentration of dark matter, Asher concluded. Seriously dense, all around the ring, and complex with powerful gravitational fields capable of manipulating masses on a very large scale. I mean more than stellar masses, clusters of stars, maybe even dwarf galaxies.
Leith, Nicola said.
Huge energies being expended across a tremendous volume. Masses hurled in at the ring and planet-buster fire in return. Attack and offence. This is a war zone. Max Ward is going to love it.
Asher said, we can't be sure of the interpretation.
Look, I'll jump to conclusions if nobody else will. All the way out there, the Chili are building a tremendous artifact in the middle of intergalactic space, so big it's distorting the entire structure of the cosmos around it. And creatures of dark matter are trying to stop them. That's how it looks to me.
Jophiel shook his head. It's unbelievable.
But if that's anywhere close to right, it shows that the war we're engaged in here, humanity's war with the Chili, is only a fraction of the bigger picture, a detail.
But a significant detail, maybe, Asher said.
She smiled. Questions? The meeting soon wound up after that. Jophiel knew he would spend a lot of time considering what he'd learned, not least about himself and Michael Poole. They stood together, awkward mirror images. Aside from the two of them, only Nicola remained. Michael glared at her, staying to gloat.
About what? Your personal angst?
Look, Poole, from the minute that Chili poked its nose out of your wormhole, it's obvious you've been mired in a tangled mess of overwhelming moral complexity. You're central to it, but it's not your fault. How could it be? Self-pity in you is a sign of arrogance.
Jophiel had to laugh. Is that supposed to comfort us, Nicola?
Maybe you should stick to the tough talk. She grinned.
Fair enough.
Well, here you are, on a 25,000-year punitive mission to the center of the galaxy, and that is your fault. You may be one of the few military despots in history who isn't actually a psychopath. No wonder you're screwed up. And she popped out of existence. 2 days later, with the turnover complete, the gut drive was smoothly restarted, and an agonizingly slow deceleration began. Part 4. This is a key time in human history, Aelia. A high watermark of human ambition. We've been privileged to see it, I suppose. But now, we must fall back. Luru parts, circa 500,000 AD. Chapter 33. Ship elapsed time since launch, 16 years, 328 days. Earth date, circa 28,700 AD. It took 6 more years by crew time, as nearly 13,000 more years passed beyond the ship's hull, before the Cauchy reached the central star mass the crowded space at the very heart of the 10,000 light-years wide bulge of stars at the inner terminus of the great spiral star lanes of the disk, a bulge that, Jophiel knew, the exultant generation would have called the core.